The second case set for argument is Appeal 31018, State of South Dakota versus Amanda Beetler. Drew DeGroot is appearing on behalf of the Lincoln County State's Attorney's Office, will be arguing for appellant, and Nicole Greasy is present, will be arguing on behalf of appellee. Is it Beetler? All right, with that then, Mr. DeGroot, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. The facts in this case really aren't at dispute, but I think it's important to highlight some of the facts that aren't in the briefing, and this court can direct itself to settled record, I believe it's 105 through 119, and that is just an overview of how the remote breath test system works on a 24/7 program. If authorized, a defendant can request to be placed on the remote breath test system, and if approved, they are then instructed on how to use that system by the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. They come into the Sheriff's Office, and they're instructed just on general maintenance, how to upkeep, how to charge the device, and they also choose their designated time periods of testing. They have to be 12 hours apart, and when they choose their testing times, what that does is it's programmed into the device, and the device will actually alert the defendant when it's time for that person to test. It also sends a text message notification to the defendant when it's time to test, and they're given about an hour grace period.
And there is there a cost for that also that's paid by the defendant?
There is, yes. Yes, Your Honor. And so when they're approved for using that system, they go into the sheriff's office, and they're run through a tutorial of how to use the system and how to submit their PBTs. And the system and how it works is it relies on facial recognition software. So defendants are instructed to align their eyes to the machine, and a screen prompts them on how to submit their PBT testing. It tells them to submit a sufficient blow into the device, and it will keep beeping until a sufficient blow is actually inserted in the device. After a sufficient blow is actually inserted in the device, it clicks after beeping for an extended period of time, and a flash occurs. This notifies the defendant that their PBT submission was uploaded and that a picture was taken of the defendant. And what happens after that picture and that submission are uploaded is a report is generated by Alcohol Monitoring Systems Incorporated, or AMS. Yes, that's a third party, but what happens to that report is it's contemporaneously transmitted to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, and it's also contemporaneously transmitted to the Attorney General's Central Reporting System pursuant to Administrative Rule 2461. Now, after this, in this specific instance, the defendant's submission was contemporaneously transmitted to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. It also flagged it for irregularities. There was an issue with the facial recognition software. It didn't recognize whether the defendant was the one who was submitting the PBT. And you can look at settled record page 17 in this case and the actual report that was generated to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. It's a four-corner document. It's a report. It provides biographical information of the defendant. It provides the time and date that they submitted their PBT. It provides the PBT submission, which is all zeros. And it also provides a comparison photo of when the defendant properly submitted a PBT compared to when she didn't.
So let's even be more specific. You keep saying defendants are told this, but Officer Smith actually testified that Ms. Beetler was specifically told that when you blow into this machine, it's going to take a picture of you, and it's going to transmit that picture to this machine, which is then going to file a report with the police.
That's correct, and that's why I cited to settle record. And like I said, I think it's 105 to 119 where Correctional Officer Jamie Smith testified to the instructions that Ms. Beetler received. And so in this case, when you actually look at the report, and mind you, that was uploaded into eCourts and provided to not only the court, but the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office and Defense Counsel, when you look at that report, you can see a photo where an elongated straw is used by the defendant. And if you go back to the settled record, Jamie Smith testified that each defendant's provided two straws. They're about 3-4 inches long, and they're non-bendable. But in this case, you had a photo of the defendant with what was described as a big gulp straw coming out of the system, going over her right shoulder, and appeared to be a child blowing into the PBT and submitting that PBT.
But that goes more to the question of probably falsity, and that's not being challenged here on appeal.
No, that's not being challenged here.
We're just talking about the statutory meaning of report.
That's correct, Your Honor. That it goes to the falsity and not necessarily the submission itself, but the falsity of the report. Now, The court trial was held in front of the magistrate court, and the magistrate opined that beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant had committed a false report to authorities. And the magistrate court further opined that the statutory scheme was purposely broad. In that statute is South Dakota Codified Law 22-11-9, subsection 3, reads in full, any person who makes a report or intentionally causes the transmission of a report to law enforcement authorities which furnishes information relating to an offense or other incident within their official concern, knowing that such information is false, is guilty of false reporting to authorities. That decision was appealed to the circuit court, and the circuit court, relying on definitions from Merriam-Webster Dictionary and Black's Law Edition, 12th edition, excuse me, Dictionary 12th edition, deemed that the report or the submission was not a report within the definition of the statute. Now, before I get into my argument, I think I need to apologize because sometimes there's a joke in there about attorneys making things more complicated. In my briefing, I think I made it more complicated than what this case actually is. This case is a simple set of circumstances and a simple set of facts. You know, I stand by all the arguments that are in the briefing that I believe the circuit court used the wrong definitions. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. Whatever definitions were used, this is a report. Because what else could it be? It's a four-corner document that contains a detailed account. If we're using the circuit court's adopted definition from Merriam-Webster, it's a detailed report that transcribed the submission, and that was transmitted to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. Where the state contends that the circuit court erred as it failed to apply its own definitions to the statute. Now, the state admits that there's some ambiguity in the statute. I mean, obviously, the magistrate court and the circuit court disagreed on its ultimate findings.
That doesn't mean there's ambiguity.
That's my next point, Your Honor. I don't believe there is ambiguity. The magistrate court, I think, hit the nail on the head when it reached its ultimate conclusion. And so when we're looking at statutory interpretation, the purpose of statutory interpretation is to discover legislative intent.
So in your view, where did the circuit court go wrong?
I think where the circuit court went wrong, and this was going to be my next point, is I think it went wrong is it almost adopted a quasi-rule of lenity, that there were, it believed that there was some ambiguity, that the statute needed to be defined. It adopted and strictly construed the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and applied that strictly to the statute. And so I think that's where the circuit court erred, is it didn't actually apply its own definitions that it adopted to the statute.
Well, do we even need to look at the dictionary or meanings of words? I mean, when I look at the statute, it talks about, you know, makes a report or causes transmission of a report, and then to me it defines report as information relating to an offense or other incident within the official concern. Isn't that the report?
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor.
So why do we even need to reference a dictionary definition?
I don't think we do. And that was going to be my point, and that's where my point is. I think I overcomplicated this, and probably an apology to the circuit court, overcomplicated the issue that we don't necessarily need to define it and look to the dictionary definition. I think in researching this, my favorite quote from Stevens v. State in the state of Arkansas, the number one rule of statutory interpretation is making use of common sense. And when you look at the report that's before this court, it's a settled record. It's a tangible document that you can actually pull from the settled record. It's a report. And in this case, when you apply that report to the actual statute, the defendant intentionally caused the transmission of a report to law enforcement authorities which furnished information related to an offense or other incident within their official concern. 24/7 testing and being required to comply with the 24/7 testing is within law enforcement's official concern. It's a court order. Law enforcement officers are relied upon to enforce court orders. Otherwise, it'd simply be a piece of paper or a formality. And so that's certainly within their official concern to ensure that the defendant's following those court orders. But again, going back to where I believe the circuit court erred, and I believe it strictly construed the statute in favor of the defendant. It had a report in front of it. It was in the settled record. But it deemed that the submission, it looked at just the PBT submission. It didn't, I believe the circuit court didn't view the actual report, which I believe violated South Dakota Codified Law 22-1-1, that the rule of common law that penal statutes shall be strictly construed has no application here in South Dakota. All penal statutes shall be construed according to the fair import of their terms with a view to affect the objects and promote justice. And that's what should have happened in this case. It's defined. It's an intentional transmission of a report to law enforcement furnishing information within their official concern. So when you apply the actual report to the statute, there can be no other finding that this was a false report to authorities. Now, speaking to the rule of lenity, because the defendant's argument and ultimately the circuit court's finding appeared to strictly construe the statute, and they argue that there's broad application and there's ambiguity, so therefore we have to view this in light of most favor to the defendant. This court has held in State v. Dale, to give broad application to the type of conduct, criminal laws are usually written in a fashion to give broad application to the type of conduct sought to be forbidden. There's nothing inherently wrong with broad application, for otherwise there would exist a criminal statute or law for each specific act. Most recently in State v. Ironheart, this court said, the rule of lenity requires more than simple existence of some statutory ambiguity, because most statutes are ambiguous to some degree. So even if this court finds that there's some ambiguity, it doesn't require that the statute be construed in the light most favorable to the defendant, that it be strictly construed. The purpose of statutory interpretation is to discover legislative intent. It's not to find persuasive authorities to support a conclusion. And the state would argue that's exactly what the defendant's doing by requesting this court to follow the holdings of State v. Ajito out of Iowa and State v. Branch out of Oregon. Those are two type of different statutes. They're distinguishable for a couple different reasons. In State v. Ajito in Iowa, statutes are to be strictly construed in a light most favorable to the defendant. That has no application here in South Dakota. In State v. Branch out of Oregon, yes, statutes are to be broadly construed, just like South Dakota, but there's an inherent difference in that Oregon case. The statute is completely different.
I understand your argument, and I'm understanding what you're saying about statutory interpretation. And in terms of the outcome, if we accept that, then I don't know that it matters, but it almost seemed like there was something even a little bit deeper about what the circuit court held here. Two things. One, it seemed like the court felt like this is either a 24/7 bond condition violation or it's a new offense, but it's not both. Mm-hmm. It had to be one or the other. But then the court went on and said this. Appellant's conduct may have been a violation in terms of the 24/7 program. She could face consequences for that here. But her conduct was not a specific, intentional, affirmative communication account or statement to law. So it was not an intentional statement to law. That almost seems to be a factual determination that she is taking that's consistent with the magistrate judge. Maybe that's not significant to any of it, but that one struck me as being maybe even more than just statutory interpretation.
Yeah, and I would agree with you. I think the circuit court went beyond its analysis, and again, I think that delves into strictly construing the statute. So, when the circuit court adopted the definitions out of Merriam-Webster dictionary, and then reaches that ultimate conclusion that it wasn't a statement, I think that contradicts itself.
But the court also says it's not intentional.
And I would disagree with that.
And there's a standard review. The court was reviewing court here. There's deference to the magistrate judge on that factual finding.
Correct.
And that seems to eclipse and cross into that realm, I thought, perhaps.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think because the magistrate court was the finder of fact, and I think the circuit court invaded into those factual findings without actually reaching a conclusion that the magistrate court abused its discretion. And
that could be secondary to
sure.
The more principal issue that we've got teed up, but I just was curious about your thoughts on that.
No, and I think that dovetails great into my next argument is intentional and knowing are specific elements of the crime. And so if, you know, the defendant talks about the broadness of the statute, but if you look at South Dakota statutory scheme, it's purposely limited by the intentional and knowledge definitions under SDCL 22-1-2, subsection 1, B, and C. When somebody does something intentionally, they do it with specific design to cause a certain result. By specific design, she had somebody else submit the PBT on her behalf with the intent to deceive law enforcement. Not only law enforcement, but the court. Remind you, it's a court order. Then you go into knowledge. The defendant argues that that she didn't know what she was doing would be reported or that it would break the law. But when you specifically look at subsection C, a person has knowledge if that person is aware that the facts exist which bring the act or omission within the provision of the statute. She was aware that she was not the one submitting the PBT. She was aware that a report would go to law enforcement. To claim otherwise, it was simply a lie. Everybody on every participant of 24/7 knows that law enforcement is reviewing these reports. And it's clear from the administrative rules that these reports are relied upon not only by the responding agency, but also the Attorney General's office. When knowledge of the unlawfulness of such act or omission is not required. So to claim that she didn't know what she was doing is break the law simply defies the limiting factor that's already present within the statutory scheme of South Dakota. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Group. Ms. Greasy, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. I'm Nicole Greasy, attorney for appellee Amanda Beitler. I'd start here today just with quoting Long Soldier and the statutory analysis. When a statute does not define a term, it should be construed according to its accepted usage, and a strained, unpractical, or absurd result should be avoided. And that's paragraph 13 of State v. Long Soldier, which was originally citing State v. Good Road. In essence, our arguments here today and in briefing before this court is that if you apply the state's argument, that you would, in essence, be rendering an overly broad application of the law. We're asking you to uphold Judge Miyamaga's Circuit Court Memorandum decision for two things. First, she interpreted that report as a noun, and we say that that was correct interpretation. But then also that Beitler's conduct was not a specific, intentional, affirmative communication, and that an affirmative act is necessary.
You know, I understand your argument, and maybe it's not a communication if you read that to be kind of loosely corresponding to report, okay, and then that's the statutory question we've got. But how can the court as a reviewing court, the circuit court as an intermediate reviewing court, say something wasn't specific, it wasn't intentional, when the magistrate judge, acting as the finder of fact, said that it absolutely was?
And I think what he made that factual conclusion that we're not disputing is that he said, yes, she intentionally misused her device. The question before Judge Miyamaga was, is this intentionally a report to law enforcement?
What's the difference?
I mean, so she had noticed that her conduct potentially could result in 24/7 violation, that her device could be taken from her, that she could be sat in jail, that she'd face the 24/7.
Whether she understood that she could be prosecuted for this or not doesn't impact our interpretation of the statute.
Well, one of our arguments was within due process and that she didn't have notice of the same. But potentially what the state is saying is that any dishonest interaction with law enforcement would result in a false reporting charge. I mean, if you stopped on the side of the road and they say, do you know why you've been pulled over? And you say no, but you were speeding 15 miles per hour over. If you apply the broad way and the definition that they're asking you to today, you could then charge them not only for speeding, but for false reporting.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that, but I don't know that this decision needs to be a referendum on whether we license people to lie to the police or not.
And I'm not asking for that. I think that there was clear legislation intent in cutouts.
I mean, people shouldn't probably lie to the police.
And we have false impersonation statutes for that specific reason. You don't lie about your name or your background. We have that in misprision. You can't withhold information about a felony. I mean, this would be redundant to then have a full carve out, a statute that basically says that you can never lie to police.
That seems like a policy argument. What about the text? The text is pretty self-contained, it seems like. Makes a report, causes the transmission of the report to law enforcement authorities which furnish information relating to an offense or other incident within their official concern. Where textually is the difficulty with sustaining or affirming the magistrate judge's position?
Yes.
What's the problem?
So I think clearly in the statute, if you look at makes a report, that's very strong language, or intentionally causes the transmission of a report. Both of those clauses they support Judge Mamiga's finding that is very strong affirmative language that would provide that you need an initial affirmative act within law enforcement for that to qualify.
So why isn't an affirmative act falsely using your device, knowing that as a result of that, a false report is going to be transmitted to law enforcement?
I think that the results there would be absurd in that it would be every false 24/7 violation.
Well, but and I'd like you to address the argument that your opposing counsel is making today, even if you do use the definition the circuit court used, and that this is a noun, it's referring to a report. Why isn't this the causing of a transmission of a report to law enforcement by her affirmative act?
So it's not a report in that it's not an account or a narrative of her, it's a breathalyzer photo. So the AMS took the breathalyzer photo on the device, and then that was submitted and sent to AMS. So it wasn't communication, it wasn't oral, it wasn't her coming out right saying, hey, I am clean, you know. It was a photo of misusing the device.
Except that there's evidence that she was informed that the specific purpose of the device is to have them blow into a machine and have it confirmed that it's them that's giving the negative test result.
And that it could be used against her in 24/7. I agree that, and it was just and reasonable that she was violated from the 24/7 program.
Why couldn't it be both?
I think that's an overly broad or vague. I mean,
That's a policy decision. I mean, if people don't like the way that the prosecutor acts or thinks they charge or overcharge or whatever, they can take that up with the prosecutor or elect their own prosecutor or do whatever they want to do. But why is it this either or proposition? Why is it this either or proposition? It's only a violation of a bond condition, and that can, because it is, it can rise to the level of being a criminal offense just for some reason of whatever, proportionality or something, I don't know.
I think the court has to today look at the legislative intent. And did legislature intend this to apply to 24/7 violations?
But we've said that we do that, but where the text is clear and it's unambiguous, we accept that as the legislature's intent.
So where's the existence of the intent that the legislature didn't intend it to apply to 24/7?
I think that if they intended to do so, I think they would have clearly done so. I think within here that they're saying that this applies when you make a report or intentionally causes the report. I mean, what
we're supposed to put parenthetical, including 24/7 testing results?
I would support Judge Mamiga's her further ruling. So first she makes the ruling that this is defined as specific intentional affirmative communication. But then she says further that a breathalyzer submission, such as the facts here, that is the misuse of the device, that is not a communication for purposes of the statute.
What is it, I wonder? I mean, it goes to somebody, right?
The photo of a breathalyzer?
That's not a communication.
It goes to the AMS third party, correct.
So she never wouldn't it be communicated to them that way?
The communication through the AMS to the sheriff's office?
Yes.
Yes.
Isn't that a communication?
I'm arguing it's not communication.
But why isn't it a communication? You're sending them a message.
Because I don't think the legislator intended it to apply to bodily submissions of fluid.
Well, I know, but I mean, why isn't... But you're saying that you don't think it... I understand that, but why isn't that a communication? Here's my picture. I'm doing this. You need to monitor it. It's a condition of my bond. I'm sending it to you now. And why is that not a communication?
I think she was reporting as court-ordered compliance as part of the 24/7 program. That she was not she was not taking an affirmative act to communicate with law enforcement to lie to them about a report. And if we go through, I do agree with the state, I mean, on the general resuscitation of the facts, and going through in our briefs, we go through the statutory history of legislative intent, and that it did broaden it from when it originally was invoked in 1975. to when it was amended in 1976, I do agree that there are times that we look to the Model Penal Code. But even looking to the Model Penal Code, 241.5 reports to law enforcement authorities an offense or other incident within their concern, knowing that it did not occur, which again, the report then is providing an account of. And I don't think that it was ever intended for that to be the bodily submission of fluids through court-ordered compliance of the 24/7 program. So looking at that statutory history and legislative intent, we think it does support upholding Judge Mamiga's decision to find, if you find that it's a noun, but then also to find that further, that it doesn't apply to the bodily breath or blood.
So let's say, let's take this scenario. If we accept your view of the statute, let's say state and defendant come in on a criminal case, they have a plea agreement, defendant's going to provide a proffer at the end of the case. That's part of the condition of probation that the court orders, you're going to provide a proffer. And let's say defendant comes in then and just lies all over the place, makes false reports about all kinds of things. How is that any different than this 24/7 scenario? Or is that not a crime in your view?
No, I think if you relate it to the persuasive authority that we both noted in our briefs, a lot of that persuasive authority analysis hinges on, does it require additional law enforcement investigation? Are we utilizing extra law enforcement resources to look into this? So here with the facts on Beitler, they weren't. This was the regular routine supervision of Beitler through the 24/7 program. There was no additional subsequent investigation or additional resources. And I think that in that proffer instance, it would, I mean, they'd be looking into the lies that were told. So it would be a subsequent investigation, and that would result in a false reporting. I mean, there are times when false reporting makes sense. I'm not here to say that.
So what I'm saying, though, is it seems like your differential is she's being required to make this communication or report or whatever you want to call it. Same thing happens with the proffer as a part of a sentence and as a part of a condition of probation, isn't it? So what's the difference there between those two? You're saying it's because they have to do more investigation?
Right. I think that the persuasive authority from the other states, from Iowa, Oregon, Tennessee, it hinged on did it require utilizing additional resources? Because that's the heart of why false reporting was created. Is they wanted
how much utilization would it have to take, I wonder? Would it be enough to have... it's not enough to have the recognition software become engaged and then have somebody push a button so that she can start her car. It has to be more, but how do we know how much more?
Well, because with the 24/7 program, they're already routinely supervising these people. They're looking at every single blow.
But that doesn't mean they're not working. That doesn't mean they're not doing something
right.
Affirmative. But so I'm having a hard time understanding that distinction, I guess.
I don't think it makes that affirmative action that initiates the report, that initiates that report to them to say...
Well, she didn't take an affirmative action, or the police didn't? I'm sorry.
Right. It was circumvented through the AMS system.
Yes.
And then it was flagged and said, hey, you violated the 24/7, come on in.
Right. But you're saying your argument is that what? I thought your argument was that the police need to engage affirmatively more. But you're...
No. That the person that's making the intentional falsehood would need to make that affirmative action in creating, you know, to reach out to law enforcement to make that communication. So ultimately here, I'm saying that if you're taking the common sense and reviewing the words by their clear meaning, reading the statute as a whole, and kind of considering the results that will apply from today's ruling, that legislative intended this to be an affirmative act, that it's clear that it did not intend to apply to bodily fluid submissions under 24/7 program. For those reasons, I'd be asking you to uphold Judge Mamiga's memorandum opinion. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Greasy. Mr. Groot, you may proceed with rebuttal.
As I stated in the initial arguments, this is a limited set of circumstances, a little limited set of facts. Perhaps I made it overcomplicated in my briefing, but that's what this is. The state's not trying to prosecute every single violation of 24/7. We have false submissions all the time. What's specific to this case is the report that was generated. You know, the defendant spoke to the Model Penal Code and the intent behind the legislative intent behind the statute. It's clear that this statute was adopted from the Model Penal Code. And the defendant cited to some of the commentary, but the defendant failed to continue the quote. And the quote is other incidents within their official concern or other reports within other contexts. And that's exactly what this is. It's a report to law enforcement within their official concern. And the defendant also states that there was no investigation conducted. That's simply just not true. We wouldn't be here today if there was no further investigation. You could look at settled record page 16, and you can look at the settled record and going back to correctional officer Jamie Smith. He testified that he received an alert. He reviewed the report. He conducted an investigation. Not only did he conduct an investigation on this submission, but he actually conducted an investigation to past submissions where there was no flag on the facial recognition software. And I'm not going to get into the factual dispute with the magistrate court, but I'd argue at least one of those other submissions was more egregious than this one. But I digress. At the end of the day, again, this is a limited set of circumstances and a limited set of facts. We don't need to delve into hypotheticals that the state's attorney's office is going to use this to prosecute anybody who lies to law enforcement, because we do still have those limiting factors. We have the intent. Definition of intent, we have the definition of knowledge.
I mean, I don't know how that fits in anyway. I mean, we read the statute,
yeah.
And I, you know, I guess the prosecutor makes the prosecutor's decision. This isn't about, you know, some allegedly improper exercise of prosecutorial discretion. I mean, that's sort of intimated, but I mean, that's not the issue. That
correct,
we're
and I don't think it is. And I indicated in my brief that I don't think it has any argumentative value to delve into the prosecutorial discretion. What we have in this case, I mean, you talk about initiation. One is the state contends that initiation isn't required, and that's clear from the Model Penal Code. If you look at the commentary, you could also look at, you know, if we were talking about dictionary definitions, Black's Law Dictionary from the 5th and 6th edition. Back in those cases, they actually cite to State v. Fenster out of the state of Connecticut where initiation wasn't required. So if you're looking at legislative intent, again, the purpose is to discover legislative intent. It's not just find conclusions from other persuasive authorities and then insert that conclusion into South Dakota law. And that's exactly what the defendant's proposing is, hey, we should adopt the Oregon analysis when the statute is completely different. And in this case, there was initiation. Even if initiation was required, initiation is present. She made the autonomous decision, independent autonomous decision, to submit a PBT that wasn't hers. She had a child do it. For all intents and purposes, it appears a child submitted that PBT on her behalf. She, by specific design, had somebody else submit the PBT. And we're not arguing that the breathalyzer itself is the actual report, is at issue here. It's the report she caused to be transmitted. And I'd argue, going back to the unambiguous nature of the statute, the legislature had the foresight when it inserted transmission. It had the foresight to believe that there was technology coming in the future that would cause transmission, that it wasn't simply somebody relaying a statement to law enforcement. We don't need to go outside the statute. It's clear and unambiguous when you actually read the statute as a whole. I'd argue that it makes a report. You can ignore that completely in this analysis of limited set of circumstances and limited set of facts. Any person who intentionally causes the transmission of a report, so any person, we have that. Any person who causes the transmission of a report, we have that. We know it was transmitted to law enforcement. We also know it's within their official concern. They're relied upon by courts to enforce 24/7 conditions of bond. And it furnished false information. All the elements of the statute are met when you read the plain text and give the words their plain meaning and effect. Therefore, she's guilty of false reporting to authority. And we'd ask that you overturn the circuit court's decision and reinstate the correct opinion that was given by the magistrate court that the statute is purposely broad, that she intentionally caused the transmission of a report to law enforcement within their official concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drew. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is fully submitted.